Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager bringing you the April 27, 2015 edition of the Heretics Hour. Thanks for donations from Jim from Arizona and John from New York City. I suspect that John is our caller from Thursday's final Table Talk program. It was really nice of him to call in, and he said he would try to send some money. I do recall that. And you know what? I think he did. I think that's him. And $50, too. Both John and Jim sent $50, which is very, very nice of them and certainly helps me out a lot. Speaking of Thursday's final Table Talk program, I thought I would start out tonight by giving you some of the material that I left out then about Richard Carrier's complaints about the translations. It was just too much to try to cover, you know, this one part only in Thursday's show. But I hated to kind of forget about it since I did work on it, and I think it might be useful for future reference. So the first thing I want to do is to say a few words about Heinrich Heim, who took notes. And he was born in June 1900 in Munich, and he died in the same month in 1988 in Munich, making him 88 years old at the time of his death. And according to German historian Clemens Wollhaus, he says, from a source-critical point of view, the most reliable version of the Table Talks is Werner Jachmann's edition of 1980. Oh, that's the one that has the high. All right, I guess I'm back on again. I lost my connection, and Skype wasn't getting it back, and I finally decided to hang up on Skype, and then I had to wait until the Skype call-in logo came back on at Blog Talk, and I do believe I'm connected now. So let me see here. All right. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. That hasn't ever happened for a long time. I was telling you about Heinrich Heim, and I want to tell you that Heim came from a family of notable lawyers, he being a lawyer also, and from 1939 to 1943, he worked as an aide to Bormann, which later led to his notable work recording Hitler's informal conversations. Martin Bormann put him on to this job since he was in Bormann's employee, one of his helpers. And he said that in a conversation with David Irving did an interview with Heinrich Heim at one point, and he told Irving that he had sat at a table next to Hitler's writing discreet notes throughout the meal. He was at a separate table, as we just said, and then he himself typed them up immediately afterwards, and Bormann, who was his chief, then signed each record and put them away. So that's how it worked. And after the war, these binders, they were all put in ring binders. There was quite a number of them, and they had been rescued by Bormann's widow after a little period of time. She knew about them. She got hold of them and saved them, and they came then after her. She actually, I believe, she sold them to a Swiss man because she didn't see how she was going to be able to, keep them or assure that they'd be taken care of. And so she met this man, or she knew this man. She trusted him. He was a French Swiss, François Genoux. He had been a National Socialist. He was a fan of a supporter of the Third Reich, and he said he would take care of them and see that they got published, or by a good publisher. I don't know what he said to her, actually. But anyway, she turned them over to him, and he's the one who people think, oh, he did something. You know, he might have messed with them simply because he had the opportunity. No other reason. There's no reason to blame him for that, except there is one other thing, and that is that after after all this took place, he then later wrote his own version of what would be the 1945 Table Talk, and he tried to publish that as a as a legitimate thing. And he was kind of found out, but not right away. And what he said to David Irving, according to Irving, was, this didn't come from Hitler, but it's exactly what he would have said, don't you think? And this doesn't make for a very good impression of François Janoux, but there's no reason to believe that he changed anything in the real table talk notes. In any case, that's the reason to suspect him of funny business, if you think there is any funny business. Anyway, François Janoux sold table talk notebooks to the publisher Wiedenfeld, who was an Austrian refugee in Britain, for it is mostly thought to have been about £40,000. £20,000 he wanted for himself, and he directed the publisher Wiedenfeld to make out a check for Paula Hitler, for $20,000. And he did see that Paula Hitler, Hitler's sister, received that quite large sum of money, because she was not in very good, very prosperous means at that time. So that was very good of him. He really was a good man. He was a sincere National Socialist. And I guess he thought that he was so familiar with the table talks, and maybe was sorry that they didn't go beyond a few weeks in 1944, that he should add to them and make right up to the close to the time of Hitler's death, he had it all worked out there. And I guess they were pretty good, but they weren't real. They weren't genuine. So in any case, some of the historians and critics, and they always seem to be British, but Michael Burley contrasted Hitler's public pronouncements on Christianity with those in table talk, you know, his other sayings. And he suggested that Hitler's real religious views were a mixture of materialist biology, a faux Nietzschean contempt for core as distinct from secondary Christian values, and a visceral anti-clericalism. Well, you know, this last part, the anti-clericalism, comes from Hitler's experiences with the church leaders when they decided to oppose him on some of his policies, and he found them not living up to the concordat or the agreements that he made with them in his mind, and they had decided, I guess, that he hadn't lived up on his end, and lived up to them on his end, and so they didn't have this agreement wasn't working any longer. But anyway, it made Hitler somewhat bitter against the church bishops, and both Catholic and Protestant. But to say that he had a faux Nietzschean contempt for Christianity, for Christian values is what they say here, for Christian values, is really wrong. In the first place, Hitler was not Nietzschean at all, and he was not a materialist. He was not an atheist, and he was not against Christian values, but Christian dogma. It was Christian dogma that he didn't like. So I don't think much of Michael Burley's description there, but Richard Evans is another very well-known British philosopher, British historian, as probably a lot of people recognize his name. And he also reiterated the view that Nazism, and, you know, to call it Nazism, it's just so, you know, they can't call it National Socialism. They refuse to do that. And they can't call it Hitler's views. Why not just say, if he means Hitler's views, and there's a difference between National Socialism and Hitler's personal views. But they just throw this stuff around. They're really very unprofessional, these PhD high-level historians. He says that Nazism, as I just said, we don't know what that is, but was secular, scientific, and anti-religious in outlook. In his last book, I would say that most Germans were unaware of Hitler's anti-Christian views, because he basically spoke and presented himself in public as a nominal Christian. So there was never And he never formally left the church either. And I think he did this on purpose. I mean, he knew if he had made a decision to break with the church personally, well, for first it wouldn't do any good, and also it would cause a whole lot of talk and upset and distraction and so on. So why should he do it? He never did it. And it also might have been a gesture to his mother. But people, most of the Germans considered that he was Catholic, and if he didn't attend church, he wasn't a very good Catholic, but he still was, and he never gave the churches any trouble, and the churches continued to always get their money from the state. So a lot of these things that these people write seem silly to me. And Richard Carrier maintains that much of Trevor Roper's English edition is actually a verbatim translation of Janus' French and not from the original German. Now, that's just plain ridiculous, as I said on Thursday. And he says this because he thinks that they might have been altered. It'd have to be might, because he doesn't know, but he says he thinks that they were altered by François Janus as part of a deliberate forgery to enhance Hitler's views. Now, he has no proof for that, but that's his idea that he wants to put forth. He calls it to make Hitler appear anti-Christian, as he says Janus did, more anti-Christian than he really was to enhance his views, to enhance Hitler. Because Carrier is an atheist, and he dislikes Christianity. He's a big, big critic of the whole historic Jesus and the whole thing. So he doesn't want Hitler to be the same as he is. He wants to be different. He wants Hitler on the other side. So he thinks that to make that any effort to make Hitler anti-Christian is making Hitler look better. And that's why he thinks they did it. At least that's what he says. And so the work that he supposedly did, that so many of these white nationalists who are Christians bring forward whenever they want to argue for the fact that table talk is not really Adolf Hitler's words at all, either in whole or in part. He and a partner that he had working with him, this is Carrier, retranslated 12 quotations from Hitler's table talk in the one that's in the Library of Congress, in a way to show Hitler as a Christian. Well, I don't know what version is in the Library of Congress, and they never say, but it's obviously what he took his from was the Picker notes. And Henry Picker only took notes for about 4 months in 1942, from, I don't know, what was it, through September or something like that, from early summer to September. And then Haim came back. But he chose these quotations according to what's written from Picker's original German text that is in the Library of Congress, I guess. And he compared them to Janus' French translation. And he said that what he found was that Janus' version is a poor translation. I don't even know what Janus' version is exactly. But you see, this is not, none of this is ever very clear, but we do have some examples of what he thinks that these quotes, that this translation, which is Picker's original German text, and Janus' French translation show that they were translated from Janus, I guess. The Cameron and Stevens. No, I'm still left here. I only wanted to point out that he took his quotations, his Hitler quotations, from Picker's, not from Haim's notes, but only from Picker's notes. And there's two examples here that I want to go into. They don't show at all that it's a bad translation. In fact, what it shows me is that it's Carrier who does the poor translation. from the German. That's the best I can see from it. It's Carrier who does the worst translation. So the first example is Cameron. In Cameron Stevens, it says the words are, "The time in which we live is the appearance of the collapse of the matter." And in Carrier says that this should be, "The time in which we live has the appearance of the collapse of this idea." So, all right. The whole paragraph in which this sentence occurs reads as follows. I have never found pleasure in maltreating others, even if I know it isn't possible to maintain oneself in the world without force. Life is granted only to those who fight the hardest. It is the law of life. Defend yourself. The time in which we live has the appearance of the collapse of this idea. It can still take 100 or 200 years. I am sorry that, like Moses, I can only see the promised land from a distance. Well, now here we have the sentence that matters here is, "The time in which we live has the appearance of the collapse of this idea." So he's saying that you have to fight to live, and that in our time, this idea has lost its value, or this idea, he's calling it, has collapsed. People aren't living according to this idea. And he says it can still take 100 or 200 years for this idea to come back, you know, in fashion, say, in use. And then he says, "Well, I'm sorry that, like Moses, I won't see it. You know, I only see it from a distance. I won't be there when this occurs. I won't be around when this happens." But he's expecting, according to what he's saying right here, that this idea that the law of life is that those who fight the hardest are the ones who win, will come back. And he would like to see it, but now the fact that he says like Moses doesn't mean that he's comparing himself to Moses or feeling religious about it, but they had been talking about Moses. He had been talking about Moses and some things like that previous to this, and so that's why he adds that he's sorry that, like Moses, he can only see it from a distance. Or he's pretty familiar with the Bible, so he knows that Moses died before they got to the Promised Land. And anyway, saying that the time in which we live has the appearance of the collapse of this idea, how is that different? How does that make Hitler more Christian than to say that the time in which we live is the appearance of the collapse of the matter? And which one is correct? Is correct, because I looked at the German. In fact, it's right here. Die Zeit, in der wir leben. The time in which we live ist die Erscheinung, whatever it is, and on, you know, would be is the appearance of the collapse of the idea. So the German is, and that's how it is translated by Cameron Stevens, but Carrier changes it from is to has. It has the appearance and not is the appearance. But how big of a difference is that? And how does that change anything? I really find it ridiculous. You know, these two examples that are used should be the best that Carrier had, or the ones that make it most clear why this is an issue. But I sure can't see that there's any issue here. And the next one, I'll give you the other one too, because it shows that they're very similar. And this one is the sentence that is at issue in the middle of a paragraph says, "I shall never come personally to terms with the Christian lie." Now, this is supposed to be one of the terrible things that Hitler said, and that shows how much he dislikes Christianity by calling it a lie. So I put that through Google Translate. They come out with it. One should never personally add such a lie. And the German does indicate he's not saying I. For he is saying one. Or man. Mankind or something. So I asked Hanning Scott to translate it. And he translated the whole paragraph, but I'll just stick with this one sentence. The whole paragraph is kind of interesting, but Hanning's translation says, one may never individually go along with such a lie. And then, so we've got Cameron and Stevens. I think they are wrong on this one, but I don't know how serious it is. You know, they changed it to I shall. Google says one should, and Hanning says one may. And Carrier translates it, one should never personally accept such a lie. Now, what the lie they're talking about is the lie of the Christian doctrine. I don't know how else better to describe it. It's like it's Christian doctrine that he's speaking of. So whether he says, I won't come to terms with it, or one should never go along with such a lie, you know, whether it's me or whether it's people in general. And the word... Now, here's where Carrier is absolutely wrong in his translation when he uses accept. He says one should never personally accept such a lie. Looking into these words, the word is fügen. The word for that is to put, whether it's to add to or to accept or to add. Actually, the translation for fügen is put. And fuge is add. So it would be to add or to put such a lie, to put forth such a lie. One should not put forth such a lie, is what he's saying. And that would be the correct translation. Whereas Carrier changed it to accept. And that is not one of the choices for fugen, F-U-E-G-E-N. Accept is a word, the first selection for accept is akzeptieren. I never heard of it. Akzeptieren. And then a bunch of other choices were accept, but none of them are fügen or füge. So in both of these cases, we see Carrier mistranslating one of the words in order to make it different. So, you know, there was nobody that agrees with Carrier, except maybe a few friends of his. But most historians have concluded, as it's always said, that table talk is authentic. And there's this person, Derek Hastings, who has written more about it than a lot of them. And he rejects Carrier's thesis, saying it's an attempt to undermine the reliability of the anti-Christian statements. And this very well-known Sigmund Gall also looked into it a lot and wrote a lot about what Carrier wrote in his own book. He gave it a real fair hearing, you know. But he ultimately says that the table talks are authentic and he disagrees with Carrier. So nobody agrees with Carrier, and he's pretty much dropped it. So I just want you to know that when people come along, when someone comes along and says, oh, that table talk, you can't believe anything here, this is what Richard Carrier, a well-known historian, has written about it, and you can copy and paste his whole pages by him. It's sounding very authoritative, and you wouldn't know if you don't, you know, if you don't analyze it yourself, or you don't know, even if you do know some German, if you don't really sit down and study it all, you know, look at it carefully, you'll just say, oh, you know, because he keeps putting in these, he just continues to say that this is wrong and that's wrong and this has been this has been poorly translated and so on. And he's just pulling the wool over everybody's eyes. And so you can come back with that if you run into that problem. And that's the last I have to say about that, but I do want to make that very clear. Now, I want to talk a little about a few things about white people, European people, and white nationalism sort of on the sidelines there. And I saw what I thought was an interesting article by Patrick Buchanan just yesterday. It's probably his latest one. And he writes, this is titled, Pat Buchanan, Is the European Union Dying? In an essay, I'm going to just make a few little quotes from his much longer article. And he wrote, in an essay, The EU Experiment Has Failed, Bruce Thornton of Hoover Institution makes the case that the verdict is in, the dream is dead, the EU is unraveling. One Europe is finished. Buchanan writes, for a nation to survive, its women must produce on average 2.1 children. Europe has not seen that high a fertility rate in 40 years. Today, it is down to 1.6 children. Europeans are an aging, shrinking, disappearing, dying race, he writes. A fundamental question has troubled European unification since the Treaty of Rome in 1957, writes Thornton. He's back to quoting Thornton. What comprises the collective beliefs of and values that can form the foundation of a genuine European-wide community? That's the question. What are the collective beliefs that can form a genuine European-wide community? And he asked also, what is it that all Europeans believe? They've lost religious belief, which is the religious belief of Europe was Christian, and that's what's been lost. That's the only religious belief that's been lost. And they've been replaced by political religions. He says communism, fascism, Nazism. There's that Nazism again. They are substitute gods that failed. Well, I disagree there because fascism and Nazism did not fail. They were wiped out. You know, they were destroyed by communism and Zionism. What's the other one? One world governmentism, so internationalism. So that's wrong to say that they failed. And so often people are saying, well, lately I've been seeing a lot of comments that people say, Hitler failed, his National Socialism failed, and now we have to come up with something different. Well, you know, it didn't fail. It was very successful, and neither did fascism fail. But they were destroyed by their enemies, who were bigger than they were. And let's see now. Buchanan quoting the Hoover guy, or it's Buchanan. But anyway, nor has secular social democracy succeeded. It has not provided the people with a transcendent principle that justifies sacrifice for the greater good or even gives people a reason to reproduce. So Europe has installed, since World War II, secular social democracy. We know that. But that hasn't motivated people to sacrifice or to work for something good for them, for their entire race, I guess, hasn't made them want to reproduce either. So Buchanan says pacifism beckons. Every major European nation in NATO, Britain, France, Germany, and then he includes Italy and Poland too, will see defense spending in 2015 below 2% of GDP. So they don't want to spend the money on defense. They don't want to go to war. They don't want to fight anything. They want peace. They want prosperity. They want to just continue on, things to continue on this way. So Buchanan says Christianity gave Europe its faith, its identity, purpose, and will to conquer and convert the world. Christianity created Europe. this is in Buchanan's view, and the death of Christianity leaves the continent with no unifying principle save a watery commitment to democracy and la dolce vita. So, I believe he's right about that. There is no motivation and there's no unifying principle in Europe except this idea of democracy and the good life. You know, we're going to live the good life. And the Europeans certainly started living the good life. Of course, it took a while for the Eastern Europeans to be able to do that, since they were under the communist Iron Curtain. But that's what the Western Europeans got used to, and that's what they want. Now he continues a little more. He says, or I've got a little more of what he wrote. The descendants of fallen away European Christians of the 19th and 20th centuries are finding their new faith in old tribal and national identities, says Buchanan. Less and less does multiculturalism look like the wave of the future. Well, he had started talking about the nationalist parties, and mostly he mentions UKIP, Britain's UKIP, and France's Front National, and then he wants to include Germany, obviously, as the big three of the European Union, you know, that you can't do without. If any one of these three, Britain, France, or Germany would pull out, well, that would destroy the whole thing, but... So he mentions Pegida. Well, Pegida is not anything major, and it doesn't even, I don't even know if it's going to continue, and it's not very strong, and it's not like the others. So, but that's what he says anyway, because obviously he wanted to show this movement in these three big European key nations. And so he's saying he thinks that this looks like the wave of the future, nationalism. And, you know, he says he see it in Russia and in everywhere, you know, other places too, a lot of places in Europe. Well, I say that nationalism will not unify Europe, as it certainly can't be unified under white nationalists. You see, how is the independent nationalisms going to unify Europe? Unless they could unify themselves after they take over their, somebody's here listening, after they take over their own nations, if they can even do that. Well, once they did that, how are they going to, they might try to cooperate with one another, but will they all get elected? I don't see this, but people talk in terms of white nationalism in Europe as one big white united group. In my opinion, that will never happen. That will never happen. Under Hitler, it was possible with a strong German dominance. Under Adolf Hitler, at that time, it was possible to unite Europe because you would have a strong German control over everything and holding it together. But now, Germans are wimpy. They're even though they're prosperous and productive, but they're so guilt-ridden, you know, and they're unwilling to really lead anything. They don't feel they're worthy of it. They don't want the responsibility. They had so much trouble before. So you can't, you know, Germans are not there to do that, and the others can't do it. And that brings me to the next story I want to go into, which is that yesterday, German President Gauck, he thanks Britain for liberation of the camps. He thanked Britain. Yesterday, they had a commemoration in three places in Europe commemorating the liberation of the Nazi camps, the Nazi concentration camps, as of the 70th anniversary. And, of course, it was all organized by the World Jewish Congress, or the and Ronald Lauder. So just like the one in January for Eastern Europe, now for Poland, and so on. Now this is the one for camps in Germany, and also they included the one and only supposed camp in France, and a camp in Croatia. But it was not a very big deal. There's one story for it, thank goodness, and now it's just all forgotten about. Although there will be the May commemoration of the end of the war, but this one was just for the opening up of the concentration camps. And at the site of Bergen-Belsen, that was where one of them took place, in Germany, the president of the World Jewish Congress, Ronald Lauder, was there speaking. He recalled the shock of the images and so on and blah, blah, the bulldozers, and he makes a big deal out of all that. But the other one was at Jasenovac, might be. It's in Croatia. The camp there that's supposed to have been so bad, where supposedly mostly Serbs and Jews were victimized there and killed and blah, blah, blah. So that went on, and then in France, President François Hollande was right there, as he always is, and he not only was looking, leading the memorialization at the Struthof camp in the Alsace region, close to Germany, which is supposedly also called the Natzweiler-Struthof camp, where they said a lot of things took place that it didn't. Now they say there's a gas chamber there, and there's a picture of Hollande and somebody else in the looking around at the pipes or something where it's supposed to be the gas chamber. And, you just think how these grown men, these leaders of these nations, they're the presidents and prime ministers and so on of these nations, there's a few more I'm going to mention, go along with all this. They don't even begin to ask a question. They're not going to, and they certainly don't want to, and they want to believe it, and they're totally co-opted into it. And Hollande takes the opportunity to preach and lecture about racism and anti-Semitism, saying the worst could yet return. If we don't get rid of anti-Semitism, all this bad, worst of what we've already had in the past could return again. That's predictable. But the worst part is German President Joachim Gauck, who has to go to all of these things. And, of course, this year being the 70th anniversary, he's been kept pretty busy. And he's got that fixed expression on his face, looking so serious but also contrite and sad and, just stony-like, but like he's got a lot of feeling about it. Anyway, he says that he paid tribute to the British soldiers who freed the camp and restored humanity to the country, to his country. He paid tribute. He thanked the British soldiers for freeing Bergen-Belsen, freeing up that camp, and restoring humanity to his country. And of course, they were evil thugs in that camp, the British were, and they didn't have any idea what was really going on there, and they misunderstood and just decided they knew, and they mistreated everybody there, and the people that were running the camp that were trying to turn it over to them and get their help with the problems that were going on there, the typhus problems and so on. And they just, the British were awful there, just awful. And Gauck goes on to say to them in his speech, with their actions and their approach, the British, the wonderful British with their actions and approach, driven by humanity, a new epoch began. People, the former master race, would see that human sympathy can indeed be learned, said Gauck. You just almost want to vomit when you think of this is the president of Germany today. Of course, he's not the real political leader. he's more ceremonial, but still, you know, he just always talks this way. He has no problem. Of course, he's very left. He's a left winger. They like all this stuff. But he goes on. He said more. He said, as such, they, meaning the British, were the shining counterexample to the advancing Germans, who in the years before conquered, subjugated, enslaved, and plundered Europe. Wow. What a sniveling traitor, you know. And this is what we have to deal with. So who is there to lead in Europe if there would be, you know, a nationalist movement of any kind that would get going? I don't know. Now, let's see who was saying that. Okay, Hollande was in Nazweiler, as I said, and he says, knowledge of history doesn't protect us from the worst. Anti-Semitism and racism still exist. He is constantly on that theme and trying to pass laws in France that will be more strict than what they already have. We must act to protect those who may still be victims today. So those few people, you know. And then he brings up the migrants. And that's what they talked about at this thing on Sunday that I'm telling you about. He evoked the thousands of migrants attempting the perilous journey across the Mediterranean to reach Europe from Africa and the Middle East. The EU's president, Donald Tusk, was there. Naturally, he's Polish. He's the former Polish prime minister. The Poles have a big stake in remembering all of these German crimes. And Martin Schulz, who is the EU parliamentary leader, he was there, and the other one was Latvian Prime Minister Straujuma. She goes to a lot of things. I think she was there because the Poles were there. I think the Latvians and the Poles are kind of close. They're close together, and so she's a short woman, a little bit stout. So she was there in France with Tusk and Hollande. But then this article ended with a very revealing statement without realizing it. But it said, back in Bergen-Belsen, there is little left of the Nazi camp torched by British troops shortly after it was liberated on April 15, 1945. To prevent the spread of deadly diseases, you see, they had to practically burn down the camp because there was a typhus epidemic there, and the typhus was so dangerous for everybody. That's why, and that's they say that here, and yet they want you to think that that all this was being done on purpose, all this death. Making these people's lives. Well, this person that I'm done with that. All right, this person who was on the line left. I don't know if they wanted me to answer their call or not because the mic never lit up, only the listening part. So it's kind of difficult if this press one thing is not working. But if this person wants to say something, they're welcome to call back again. And I'll click on their mic to bring them on online. I'm happy to have any callers tonight, so they're welcome to do that. All right, today another thing that happened today in the USA is that Loretta Lynch was sworn in as the new Attorney General. Loretta Lynch is black, and she is taking the place of what's his name? I can't think of his name now, our former one. And so I look at the picture, you know, that is on the with the news story. And there's three black men and her. That makes four. And one white guy, that was Joe Biden, who was swearing her in. So, you know, this is one of my complaints that we see, we have to look at black people so much as though they're an equal portion of this country. Well, they're still a minority, but who knows, they're getting, probably getting closer to being even. They're not really close to being even, but they are getting closer. And so, but we see black faces whenever you look anywhere on the internet, going through the news, black, and in the advertisements and so on, black, and you know, I'm not black, and I don't want to look at black people. And I know they say black people had to look at white people all those years, but you know what? This is a white country, and it's still a white country based on white people who founded it and started it and built it and so on. It's not a black country. Why? You know, where you expect, you think, well, they have every right to be seen as much as we do. Well, I don't agree with that. And these are the things that affect me. You know, I can stay away from other races as much as possible if I don't want to be around them. But they're moving in more and more, closing in more and more, and you have to be... You have to be exposed to all of that. So who is going to do something for the white race? I think that not white nationalists. I don't believe in white nationalism. It doesn't make sense to me. Of course, I've said this before. I'm always trying to say it in a different way. It might make more of an impression. But... white is not something to define people with. I realize that there are white people, and I'm happy. As I was just saying, I don't like having to look at black people all the time. I want to look at white people. So if I have a neighbor that I don't really hardly know, but he's a white person, and it turns out he's a Czech or something, or he's a Hungarian, ethnic Hungarian, or a Russian or something, but if he's white and if he's quiet, whatever, then I have no problem. I'm glad he's there. But I'm still saying that we need to preserve our ethnicities. And white nationalism seems to think that white is all it takes for people to get along just fine together. But I say there's too much disparity in IQ and in temperament, in cultural values, among white people. But I think that Western European whites are pretty congenial together, and Eastern European whites are pretty congenial together. But I don't see that breaking down all those barriers is a good idea. Now, some thoughts that I had based on this yesterday, waking up, as I wake up in the morning and I'm half asleep still, and I'm thinking, say, about the radio program, and I'm thinking of different ideas and approaches, and then more as I wake up, more and more thoughts come into my mind. So this is what was going on. And I was thinking that Hitler's National Socialism is the only path that can save the white race and culture. And I've said this before, people don't agree with me, of course. And yet I just can't see where there's anything better, because there's never been any other that has been successful. No program, no white people's program has been truly successful except Hitler's National Socialism. Well, yeah, you had the British coming to the United States, but that was a brand new country. But it didn't take long before they started mixing people, non-white people, in with themselves. So that didn't work either. Now, those who say, as I already alluded to earlier, that Hitler failed, well, they failed to get it, because Hitler succeeded. He did not fail. But his fellow whites in other nations failed, and they're still failing. And, you know, we're failing because we won't look to that success story and continue to follow it and model ourselves after that and build on that. I don't see any other way that will work. And you know what? If somebody would come up with one, well, then I could say, well, that Carolyn Yeager doesn't know what she's talking about. But, you know, nobody comes up with one. That's what bothers me. And that's why I feel so, that things look so hopeless, because when you look around to see what whites are doing, well, there's a few people I really admire, but they're not going to change the world. I'll say that. And they're too old to do it, too, at the ones that I'm looking up to. So this brings me to the fact that I want to say a few words about the latest entertainment at the Daily Stormer. It's not something I really want to talk about, but things have taken a turn that I thought, well, you know, I'd like to get a few words in on this. You know, Andrew Anglin, in my opinion, has turned out to be a disaster. And I used to know him pretty well. And I you know, he was a lot, very likable person. I don't know, he's the kind of person, I think, who has to be on the edge and appear to be the most radical in the movement. And therefore, he just keeps moving, looking for something new, some new way to go. He also might be fairly changeable in that he gets bored with things and he has to come up, he comes up with something new, but also might be to keep the interest up in his website, which has turned out to be his whole life, so to speak, and his whole ego and persona is wrapped up in it. But I predicted in a comment on his site, or I wasn't really making a prediction, it just came out this way, that it was at least 6 months ago, could have been a year ago for all I know. Time goes by so fast. But I said that he was inevitably going to crash or something like that. Crash and burn, I don't know if I used those words, but he was going to fall, and there was no way it was to avoid it because of the way he was. And I would just I was just going to watch it happen. People took that as a kind of a cruel statement and too unkind. But I didn't mean it that way. I just thought it was inevitable that he was going to self-destruct. And he is doing so, I think. Now, if he doesn't, then I'll have to eat my words. But I really think he is in the process of self-destructing. And even his site is coming apart technically, having a lot of technical difficulties there, it seems. Now, here's a phrase I stole from a book I'm reading right now, but it seems to fit. And it's this: Andrew seems to want to become a pop culture phenomenon. He wants to be taken seriously, see, but he also is so attracted to pop culture. And he wants to present himself in that way, too, and be a big hit in that world. And since it is a cultural product made to be consumed, what he's doing, you know, primarily either by youth or by adults who think like kids, he features stock characters like comic book characters. Human psychology is kept to a bare minimum, and the typical narrative draws a sharp and simple line between good and evil. Heroes and villains are easily recognizable, and their acts are always consistent with their identities. Well, I was going to write a blog post titled something like "The Awkward Adolescent Attitudes of Andrew Anglin," but I know that I don't want to get involved and have to reply and respond to what people are writing, you know, or responding to me about in this, and I'm always telling myself that it really is none of my business what goes on. And it isn't, you know, and I didn't care, and I don't care, except that he's going so far with it on this anti-woman thing. It's almost like a caricature. It's like a comic book, and it's hard to fathom where he thinks he's going with it, you know? So I thought I'd say a few things. You know, I think that he wants attention. And he was happy that someone wrote a new blog about him last week, and that was Matt Parrott, who wrote something, and then Andrew wrote a very long response to it. He said he wrote an elaborate defense for himself, and it was very mild criticism, but it was from Matt Parrott at Trad Youth, and he's been Andrew has been saying good things about Trad Youth, but I don't think he knows Matt Parrott. Now, Matt Parrott is no friend of mine, and I've had my own run-ins and disagreements with him. So I'm not here to defend Matt Parrott, but I think that Andrew has overreacted because he wants to make a big deal out of it. So Parrott wrote this, and Andrew took offense at. He said, but Anglin's, and he was even praising, you know, agreeing with Anglin in the beginning of this paragraph. He says, but Anglin's correct on a fundamental point. Our work is implicitly male at this stage, and we can't afford to waste time trying to make it more comfortable for or inclusive of women. Predictably, he goes astray, meaning Andrew, in his application of this point. For the same reason he, Anglin, always misses the mark, because his approach is ultimately secular, modern, and biologically reductionist. Well, Parrott always tries to sound very wordy, but Andrew takes this as an insult or as a reason to have to respond and show that Parrott is wrong about this instead of just letting it go. He's not saying that much. And so he wrote this long line-by-line reply. And either in this reply or in a second one that he put on his site, he said some things, and I've got some quotes here I want to go through. For me, the term feminine traditionalist project, this is Andrew, conjures up imagery of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, a radical Marxist group which hid behind a facade of alleged Christian tradition. Then, after he writes this, someone calls him on it, saying that the WCTU wasn't Marxist, and they never thought, why was he calling it Marxist? So Andrew does his usual thing by saying, oh, that's not what I meant. You didn't understand what I meant. He says, sorry, I didn't mean that as a literal conspiracy, merely that their positions were progressively Marxist while they claimed traditional Christianity. Well, he's still saying that the position of these Christian temperance women was Marxist. It's kind of ridiculous. This is what he always does. Whenever anybody disagrees with him, and they've got a point, you know, and he can't really answer it, he always says, well, you misunderstood. That's not what I meant. I meant something else. I'm really saying something else. And he then covers that. But, you know, these Christian temperance union women, they were anti-alcohol. That's what they were. And why do you think Andrew should really move permanently to Russia? That's where he belongs. He'd be happier there. You won't have any of these women there being anti-alcohol there. Especially since he has, I'm not going to say go there now. The solution, then Andrew says, is to do away with the concept that there is such a thing as pro-white women and accept that women are not political creatures. And that if a woman is claiming to be pro-white, she is after something. She is obviously actually saying, I'm looking for a man. Are any of you that man? More likely than not, she would be of the, I'm a hard woman to handle. I'm outspoken and opinionated, and you need to be a real man to be able to tame me. So Andrew thinks he really knows women. And, you know, he goes through all this stuff. Saying why women are, how women think and what they want and so on. And he says that this kind of a woman is the worst variety of woman, a modern phenomenon which has crawled up out of the sewer of the feminist project. Then he puts in parentheses, then again, she might be okay and genuinely looking for a man with strength, but I don't personally care. Well, now, you know, he's like, he's telling women where they belong and where they don't belong. And but then he says, whatever it is that they might, even if ones might be okay and genuinely just looking for a good man, well, he doesn't really care. He doesn't care about them at all. He's from caring about women so very much, he's gone to not caring at all about them. And then he says, I have engaged in neither disrespect or driving out. I think Parrott referred to him doing that, disrespecting women and driving women out of the movement. And Andrew said, I have engaged in neither disrespect or driving out. I have unemotionally stated my positions and backed them up as well as I could. Well, let me tell you that for him to say he's not disrespected women. When I saw that article that had menstrual syndrome daughter in the headline, I could hardly believe it. I was shocked. I thought, oh my God, he's really done it now. What the heck is that? And actually, it was the title of that article, which was a couple of weeks ago, was Father Le Pen Steps Down, Hands Over Empire to Menstrual Syndrome Daughter. So he's talking about Marine Le Pen, a mature woman, the most successful anti-immigration politician in Europe, and who he has been supporting and been speaking well of up until her father came out with his really wrong-headed statements and caused her a problem there, and she stepped right up and put a stop to it. Well, that didn't sit. And then Andrew had already started his new campaign about no women, and so he puts up, he doesn't like her anymore. He's now attacking Marine Le Pen. But to call her, use that term, menstrual toward her, or toward any woman, is really, really the lowest thing I can come up with. Truly, I have never seen anything that bad. Of all the things he's written and done, there's nothing that matches that. That's the worst of all. And this was on April 13, 2015, this article came out. And he had with it the image of one of Walt Disney's witch characters, which he's taken to showing women as witches and so on, and he subtitles it Marine Le Pen, Le Wicked Witch of France, and says that the bird on her shoulder is a rat Jew. It's just one of these cartoon witches with a bird on her shoulder. Well, what is the purpose of that, you know? What is the purpose of that except to rant and get attention? I don't know. Some of the men like it, some of them don't. I think I agree with Matt Parrott there that he's making a mistake in what he's doing, but it doesn't bother me any. I'm like him about the women. I could care less, you know, what he's doing. But it's entertainment, I'll say that. His tendency to extremism. Now, I want to bring that up. He has a tendency always to go to extremism and oversimplification. Now, here's an example, and it's from the same article that, you know, he's answering, the very long answer to Matt Parrott. He says, there's absolutely nothing. It's right there, you see, absolutely nothing. Can't possibly be true, but there's absolutely nothing in this article, he means Matt's article, which serves to forward a discussion on the topic this article was ostensibly written to address, which is my own view on gender roles. So what Matt wrote in this article about Andrew's views on gender roles contains absolutely nothing which would serve to forward the discussion. Then he puts in parentheses, truly, this single sentence could have been my entire response to this essay. You see, well, if that single sentence could have been his entire response, why didn't he leave it at that And why didn't he go on to write to answer everything that Parrott wrote point by point if there was nothing there that forwarded the discussion? So he's contradicting himself there pretty badly in crossing out what he says. He goes on, all throughout history, up until the last 100 years, white women were expected to behave as Asian women presently behave, or they would have been subjected to physical discipline. Wow. This sentence didn't follow the previous one. These are just sentences I picked out. All throughout history, up until the last 100 years, so that was in 1915, things changed. Well, okay, that's the beginning of World War I, and women became more outspoken at that time. White women, but up until then, he says, up until that 1915, white women were expected to behave as Asian women presently behave, or they would have been physically disciplined. Well, I'm not sure that is not true at all. And why is he comparing white women to the detriment of Asian women, which certainly leads one to consider, to remember his fondness for Asian women. It's showing there, and he can't cover it up because he has been more and more pointing, indicating his approval of Asian women. And some have said that he's currently in a relationship with an Asian girlfriend. And when I read something like this, you know, I have to think that's probably true, or it's very credible. Credible, anyway, when he writes like this. And I will never forget his, I wish I still had it. I think I deleted it, but I had it for a while. His post on that African 15-year-old girl, probably, just a young girl. She looked older, but you can't tell, you see, with these Africans. And that he posted on some kind of a forum or discussion place a few years back. It couldn't have been that long back because he hasn't been around that long. But it was a very, very African Congo, you know, from the middle of Africa, young girl who was all decorated up with beads and necklaces and so on. And I think she had some scarring on her body that they do on purpose as a sign of beauty, but I might have that mixed up with something else. But she had these very protruding, conical-shaped breasts standing straight out. Of course, she was naked from the waist up. And they came straight out to a point, you know, and that was the reason that Andrew, that's what he liked about it. And he was saying to the person he was writing to, don't tell me that you don't want, that doesn't make you want to grab hold of those big, beautiful breasts or those big breasts or something like that. Boy, it sure does me, and I don't believe that, you know, that you would want. So he thought that African girl was hot. You know, she sure didn't have a pretty face, but she, from a male point of view, I don't know, she had a nice body. But, you know, to think that at that time he would think it was desirable to put his body pressed up against hers and carry on with whatever he'd carry on with, and stick his face in those breasts or whatever. You know, I don't know. I'm just turned off by black skin. I couldn't possibly, never in my life could I get close like that to a black person, a black man or a woman. I don't know, particularly if they're as black as she was. You know, she was really black. And so that's just the fact that he didn't have a problem with that, and he always preferred non-white girls, and he prefers young ones too, very young. Well, that's still his problem. That has to be still his problem, and why he can't work it out as a real white nationalist as he's tried to become. He goes on and says, later, well, this is his conclusion. In conclusion, I found Matt Parrott's essay highly disappointing, given that it came across as so fundamentally dishonest, failing to address any of my points. Any of his points? I think that's not possible. That's another, these are another examples of his extremism and oversimplification. They failed to address any of his points, avoiding the core concept of my anti-feminist presentation. Well, what is the core concept of that? No, I don't know. Distorting what I said for the purpose of making it easy to attack. So, he's attackable because what he says is being distorted. I didn't notice anything being distorted. And I'm not distorting anything he says now. But this is his response all the time when he's criticized, that the other person is wrong. They haven't understood what he's saying. They haven't addressed what he's actually said. They blah, blah, blah. I found this to be the case all the way back to when he had the website Total Fascism. He's always done it this way. And he's also, I guess, what he considers the insult maybe is being called a misogynist. Parrott used the word misogynist toward him, and he considers that a bad insult, unless it was something else. But he really feels that he was insulted. And look how he talks about other people. You know, he doesn't think they should feel insulted, I guess. And this idea about feminism, too, it might come up in a little later, but, you know, he has taken to using the word feminist and feminism for women, everything to do with women, white women, you know. Every white woman is a feminist. Every concern for what women think or what women, you know, what women might feel or want for themselves, whatever, that's all feminist. And everything is feminist, which is a bad word to Andrew and his followers. That's a very bad word, the worst word of all. And that's what he has taken that, he has put that word in place for everything to do with women, or if you'd say woman or anything about women. It's all feminist. Then he finally says, Mr. Parrott is experiencing a bit of cognitive dissonance, attempting to find some middle ground between tradition, which he speaks quite highly of, and his own Marxist programming, which he probably has a hard time admitting he still suffers from. I think maybe Andrew Anglin suffers from some prior Marxist programming. But I'm not defending Matt Parrott, because I don't even know what he stands for. He's left Countercurrents, I guess, for good, and some time back, and he's just working with Christian youth and traditionalism. He's always big on that. He always was. So, you know, I don't know, but I never noticed he was Marxist. Now it seems like Andrew is seeing Marxism, everything that he opposes him, he calls it Marxist now. This is also simplistic and, you know, just pretty stupid, which is why I'm saying that, you know, I believe he is self-destructing. He's where is he going to go from here? You know, where can he go from here? And then John Friend shows up. John Friend has not commented, and, you know, they were estranged, John and Andrew, so to speak, you know, I've never seen a comment by him on there, although I'm not saying that he hasn't, maybe, and maybe he used to comment, probably, in the beginning, maybe, I don't know, I can't say for sure, but certainly hasn't been there for a long time, but this brought him out, and he writes, damn, Andrew, when I first read Matt's piece, I thought it was good, but I have to say you nailed it here. I'm having a very hard time disagreeing with anything you wrote in response to his piece. These are subjects I've never really thought too much about, but now I see their significance and importance. I'm looking forward to Matt's response. And after a day and a half, Andrew replied very cautiously, thanks, John. good to hear from you. Matt's response will definitely be interesting. Well, Andrew was talking about Matt's response from the beginning, but I don't, to him, and he's hoping for it, but I don't see why Matt has to respond. He might not. Why should he? But everybody wants to see a big discussion going on, and Andrew is hoping that some other people would also join in. You know, not me, some of these guys, white nationalist guys, would continue so they could have a big discussion on feminism. That's what Andrew calls it. He thinks he's talking about feminism and why it's so bad and what to do about it. So I don't know that there will be any response. And I don't know where it's going from here, but I want to read another comment by Andrew that I think is just sad. It's so sad. This was on April 24th on his site. A slut /shallow feminist, same thing really, he says, is definitely probably going to be more suited to a traditional role than a woman pretending to be a political activist. Sluts are just confused women acting out and demanding authority in their lives on a very base level. Well, this is just the beginning of it. But, you know, Andrew has been writing about women for a long time, actually. It's been one of his favorite subjects. Even on Total Fascism, yes, he would write about what women should do and what they shouldn't do. And he's always thinking, though, in terms of young women, women of childbearing age, women who, men are interested in. And Andrew has always been interested in a girl, not a woman, from age 15 to 18, really. That's basically his age bracket. He doesn't want anyone any older than that. 20 would be the absolute upper limit. And so he doesn't know anything about, these are girls that don't know and don't know what they are yet, you know, but, and they don't want him. He hasn't been able to find a girl or a woman in all his travels over there and going through Eastern Europe and so on that would act and behave the way he would insist. And that he would like enough. So he's had no success on that for that reason. And maybe other reasons. I don't think he's attractive at all. I don't think he's the kind of a man that women go for. I really don't. Unless you're maybe a real, hard up or something. Because I just don't think women are attracted to him. And I was going to say that a long time ago. Well, I'm getting more personal than I intended to. I shouldn't, but I always said, no, don't say that. You know, I always held back. But I've always believed it for a long time now that he won't get this white woman that he says he wants. He'll never get her. And that's what he's finally learned. And that's why he's partly why he's doing this. And he's got a lot of men following him who maybe have the same experience, you know, and so they jump on this kind of bandwagon too. And really, I don't have it's no skin off my back, you know. It's not a problem for me what these guys are doing. So why am I talking about it? Well, because it's reflects on the white movement and the white race and the possibilities for a white future. That's why. And I don't see that there's anything intelligent going on out there. That's why I say call for a return to Adolf Hitler in a real way, because there's no other model or anything to follow that would lead us anywhere good. It's just these men are so he's anyway he goes on. Let me continue what he says here. After calling women sluts, he likes to call them sluts. He said, I think it is stupid the way men complain about, oh, I don't want a woman who's had 200 dicks. And then he says, what difference does it really make in real terms? I can't see how it matters. She obviously did it for a reason, which is understandable. Did what? Had 200 dicks for a reason, which is understandable, he says. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I can't imagine caring. I guess insecure men may think, maybe think, well, she's going to be comparing my sexual performance to all these other men, and what if I don't stack up? Well, firstly, women do that a lot less than a man would imagine, as they are sexually stimulated by emotion, first and foremost. And secondly, who cares what a woman thinks of your sexual performance? Well, you know, I may be an old woman now, but I can certainly say that I never thought like that in my entire life about comparing a man's sexual performance with others. I just think that the way these guys think and are talking about women now, I suppose women have changed some from when I was a young woman and a younger woman. But it's, you know, you don't, you continue living and being a woman past the age of 20, you know. These guys think that's about it, I guess. But their whole idea seems to be so, not sarcastic, but cynical. Their whole idea is so cynical of how they're looking at women. Just because there's pictures that you can find and that spring break down in Florida and all kinds of things with white women out partying and stuff. I think it's disgusting and there's way too much of it. But that doesn't mean that the majority of white women and girls are doing that. I don't think so. Although there are far too many and probably it's far too much of an influence and maybe is growing. But this is not the answer to what to do about it. And then anyway, he says, well, that was it. Oh, yeah, he says, I wouldn't ever try and date a Nazi woman unless she was interested solely because her father or ex-lover was involved. Well, he used to want a Nazi woman. And at one time, he thought some young girl who sent him a picture of herself in a Nazi T-shirt was the perfect wife for him. And he really was serious about it, and he thought she wouldn't, though, ever give him her name and address. So he couldn't convince her that she was the perfect wife for him. But she was quite young, but he thought she was at that time because she was a Nazi. But now he doesn't want that. He wants just some dumb, he doesn't want anybody, I don't think. He doesn't want to be bothered. Well, anyway, then there's this horrible commenter named Thanatos who responded to apparently a young woman's comment, in a comment to what Andrew had written back to Matt Parrott. And this Thanatos then said a lot of weird things, like, I'm not going to read them all, but she says, perhaps there are women who'd be happy to serve you like a maid. Then he starts quibbling over what maid means and tries to make out that she's, you know, not smart enough because she doesn't know that a maid used to be a young woman, a young maiden, and blah, blah, blah. You know, that's so stupid. And then she says she thinks that in the best relationship, the couple are able to talk to each other. And his answer is, it is women that need to flap their lips constantly in order to avoid feelings of discomfort. We also don't need a partner who does 10% of the work and reaps 80 to 90% of the rewards. That's the way, you know, it's always, if a woman is talking, she's flapping her lips. You know, and if she's, if she's in a partnership, she's only doing 10% of the work and the man is doing the other 90%, but she's reaping 90% of the rewards. Stuff like that, which is not the way it really is at all. Really isn't, but and then she says, well, but one wants to know if one is welcome or not. And he says, you're not welcome to tell men. You're welcome to come here and read and comment, but you're not welcome to tell men how to behave or decide the policy of this site. Now, he goes on in these long answers. He answers everything she said and goes on and on, writing very unfriendly and attacking her for what she's saying and going into all kinds of other issues. And speaking for Andrew, one wonders if maybe Andrew is behind some of these. But I don't see how he can do so much writing, but if he would be behind some of these comment names. I never saw Thanatos on there before, but he's either a new one or I just never saw him. And she says, most women want to explore life just like any man. And he says, men don't want to do that. Men want to construct the things which you are exploring. If men were just like women, the obverse of what you are arguing, then there'd be nothing to explore, and you'd be eaten by the grizzly or lion or something before you could explore it anyway. So that's what they're always saying on there now, that women are just going to be killed and attacked when all these Muslims come and when all these blacks rise up, and they're not going to have white men to protect them. Well, I just like to know what white men are doing about this now before it happens, because they're not going to be able to protect themselves then either. I mean, what are they talking about? Who are they protecting? It's just, that's another problem, is that what are white nationalists doing besides talking to each other? What are they doing about preventing anything? So don't talk, don't say that you're doing it all when you're not doing what needs to be done at all. Then this guy says to her, seeing as how we men have been working on understanding women since 3500 B.C., and women haven't even expressed an interest in finding out who we are fundamentally as men or what we want out of women and out of life, perhaps, you know, you should be working on doing that instead of making recommendations to men. Does that make any sense? What is wrong with these guys over there? Well, he says, he says, women haven't even expressed a passing interest in meeting us 1/6 million of the way here. Is that true? Obviously not. Ever. This does sound like Andrew. It's in that extreme oversimplification and over what I said before. That's the way he writes. All they've done is take whatever we offered them and conspire behind our back with our enemies and amongst themselves to fuck us out of whatever we had left. Yeah. The only thing we need is for women to have babies and feed them and take care of them when they are young. And in another place, these men are so unwilling to have real relationships with real women. And I understand the pitfalls and the dangers in today's society for that. I do. I have some experiences with women leaving their husbands and people in my family and so on, because the man was a family member, and it's pretty terrible. But then they partly their fault too, because they allowed it to happen. They allowed the woman to have that much freedom, and they didn't even get married. They had children without getting married, and then there was no the woman wasn't that committed. So, but they went along with it just because they're unwilling to, you know, that's today's generation, I guess. At one point, someone suggested to Andrew that, you know, maybe we should think about cloning instead of making children with women. Why don't we just clone ourselves? And Andrew actually said seriously back, well, that's a very good idea. I think we should look into it. So who's going to, when you clone, do you clone an adult person, or do you clone an adult person like yourself, or do you clone a child? You clone some genes, some cells, and it turns into a baby? Well, then who's going to take care of the baby and you know, all of that? Well, you know, test tube babies, huh? Okay, then you don't need women. Well, that's their answer. We're in bad shape here, very bad shape. Now I know I've got to move on. There's a lot more I could. That's interesting, very interesting. But I really think I've said enough about this. Well, okay, my last thoughts about this is that I've been complaining for a while that Andrew uses all this Adolf Hitler imagery and National Socialist imagery, and he talks about Mein Kampf and so on. He calls himself a Nazi, and he loves to show pictures of SS men and make out like these guys who are on his website and writing comments are that's the model for them and for him, and that's what they're going to be, you know, and come on, men, stand up and fight or something like that, he'll say, as though these posters on there or anything like that, or they can create anything like that. What bothers me is that he takes then these positions, and also he has taken such a position of such a being such a fan of Vladimir Putin and everything that he does, and then he wants to call Putin the czar, the king of the Russians, and so on, and he follows him, and he does a lot of strange stuff. A lot of anti-German stuff, really, and then he wants to pretend and use all this National Socialist and World War II German soldiers imagery. And I resent it that he's doing that. I don't think he should do it. He doesn't have any right to it. And now I would say that he has left Adolf Hitler and National Socialism and Mein Kampf and all of that behind, and move to white male supremacy and traditionalism and the Bible. Oh, and he's been into the Bible for a while. He doesn't say much about it, but he seems to accept both the Old and the New Testament. So and he's got his best friend there, Sven Longshanks, who is someone who is so dishonest. He's not probably personally dishonest, but in talking about these issues, he'll say anything, no matter how wrong it is, and not worry about it. In order to bolster his case, that's what he does. And Andrew does that to some extent, but he's much smarter than Sven, so he doesn't do it to the extent that Sven does. A lot of it just out of ignorance, because he thinks he can say, oh, blah, blah, this and that. Without checking it out and without knowing. He thinks he can just say it, and then maybe the person won't know any better. But when they do know better, and then they tell him how wrong he is, he just walks away and doesn't respond or defend himself or say, oh, well, I'm sorry, I was mistaken, or anything like that. He just disappears. That's the way things go there. I haven't listened to any of Sven's readings of German National Socialism because I don't like to hear German things read with a British accent, which most of it is in a British accent. I just don't like that. So those are my that's part of why I am bringing this stuff up, because the way that Andrew and his site uses the idea that they are somehow Nazis. They never say National Socialists, but they, you know, and promote Adolf Hitler. Well, at the same time, and then he said, okay, I have to say this. Yeah, he said, I didn't write that down, but he said in there that he thinks that he answered someone in a comment that he doesn't think his ideas about his latest and most recent ideas about women are any different from those that were held in National Socialist policy, in National Socialist Germany. He says the times have changed, so some things might have come out differently, or it's only because the times have changed. But basically, what I'm espousing, what I'm saying, is exactly the same as what they said and what they did and what they believed. Well, he's wrong about that, as he's wrong about most things. He's very wrong about that, because they didn't believe in calling their women sluts, and they didn't believe in saying that you only need one woman for 10 men. Every 10 men only needs one woman, so you can get rid of a lot of women. You don't need them all. He just didn't have that idea that women should never speak. And of course, this is an issue where a lot of things could be said. But I will certainly argue and find lots of examples that contradict the fact that he says his view on this is exactly the same. See, this is what I resent, that he is, and I resent this from other people too, who want to take German National Socialism and say that they are spokespeople for it, or they it relates to them. They want to take it and wrap themselves in it because it looks good and get the aura of all of that without it being authentically deserving to do so, without really being connected to it. He's really not connected to it at all. And the only thing he's ever done, I think, is read Mein Kampf. I mean, he doesn't know that much about it. And Sven's trying to learn about it by reading all these books and or articles and things that he's reading. But he's never going to really get it either. So this is what is at the bottom of my what bothers me about what they're doing. I don't care what they do if they just leave National Socialism alone. And if they leave Hitler alone, they can say he was a great man and all of that, but to act like they're representatives of that same thing, while at the same time they're representatives of Vladimir Putin, just doesn't, it doesn't fit together in my mind. So I'm going to go now to this article on the Russian bikers, which I was happy that they were stopped at the Polish border, which the Poles promised. There are some good things that the Poles are doing here. So these, you know, these bikers, these motorcyclists group from Russia, and they're very big backers and supporters of Vladimir Putin. That's fine. That's fine. They wanted to ride from Moscow on a kind of a long route through a lot of countries and end up in Berlin for the May 9th victory celebration of the Red Army over the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS and all the others that were trying to defend, still wanting to defend Germany and defend Adolf Hitler in his headquarters in the Reichskanzlei. So this disgusting idea that they want, that these Russians want to go representing the glory of the Red Army and go to be in Berlin to celebrate that with what? With their German friends or something? Who would welcome them? The ones in the Green Party and the communists that are there for this, for the defeat of Germany in the capital of Germany? It's sick to begin with. Except that you have people like President Gauck who are so busy talking about how fortunate Germans are that the Red Army came in and liberated them. But they don't all talk like that. And I am happy. I was happy to read. I'll go to that right away. That the German government, it says in today's article, has also expressed unease at the bikers and said they would not be welcome. German Foreign Ministry spokesman Martin Schäfer said that Germany had decided to revoke the Schengen visas of a small number of people after the government concluded that there are some people we believe to be in the leadership of the Night Wolves who we do not believe are pursuing a legitimate aim with their actions in Germany. Well, they have to put it in terms of, we think these people might be spies, you know, they might be coming here to, you know, as they might be security risks or something. They can't just say, we don't want you damn people celebrating a Red Army victory in our capital. No, they can't do that, unfortunately. But anyway, back to the beginning of the story. There was 15 motorcyclists arrived at the Polish border. They tried to arrive at a small little, place that, but they were, Poland was ready for them, and they had probably had the entire border alerted. And 10 of them had visas and they wanted to enter. And the other 5 said they were just riding along until, you know, to see them off. So only there was only 10 of them who tried to enter. And the Poles spent 3 hours looking over all their papers, searching their everything they had, searching through everything, and then told them, sorry, no, you are not allowed to cross into Poland. And they put a big mark on their, those little books you have, because they're not you know, in the European Union, so they don't have a right to go into Europe wherever they want to go. So they were denied. Here's the thing. They wanted to travel across Eastern Europe to honor the Red Army soldiers who died as they and Western allies defeated Hitler's Germany, visiting their graves and other war sites. Their aim was to arrive in Berlin to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II on May 9th. See, why should they be there doing that in the enemy country? How many people, when they celebrate their war victories, go to the defeated country to celebrate it? Have you ever heard of that? I have never heard of it. And I don't think I think it's sick. It's really disgusting. But these guys, the head biker, said he was very disappointed. This is lawlessness, he says. He says we're not going to give up. We're gonna find a way in. We're gonna be in Berlin on May 9th. Well, they probably will, but maybe not. Anyway, the Russian. But listen to this. This is the way these. Why I'm just so disgusted with the way these Russians talk. The Russian Foreign Ministry demanded an explanation from Polish authorities and condemned the actions. Well, Poland certainly has a right to allow people in their country or not, if they're not part of the European Union. They certainly have that right. And why should motorcycle riders have special privilege? But anyway, you know how these things go. They said that the Polish authorities were looking for opportunistic reasons to rewrite history and, in essence, blaspheme the feats of those who saved Poland and the world from fascism. As though we wanted to be saved from fascism, but they, you know, we have to go along with that story. And you know what? I say if Russia were a decent country, they would condemn the bikers for wanting to go to Germany to celebrate Germany's defeat and Russia's victory. That's not a nice thing to do, as I already said. Okay, the Russian Foreign Ministry also said the border crossing was demonstratively strengthened by soldiers, you know, when these guys were trying to come through, as if they wanted to create the impression that the small group of Russian citizens going to Europe with the most noble aims present a threat to the Polish state. Noble aims? Right here we see that we have totally different worldviews and cannot ever combine politically with people who see the world and see history in such a totally different light than we do. Later, the Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement, it decisively condemned Poland's decision to bar entry for the bikers and said the move could be considered sacrilegious given the heroism shown by Soviet soldiers who fought against the Nazis during World War II. So, you know, that's how they do, the Russians. They make the Red Army, which was the army of the Soviet Union, all godlike because they insist that they fought the devil, which was what they called the Nazis and the fascists. So they push this and they push this. And the idea that they would call it sacrilegious, they did the same thing when it came to taking down statues of Lenin and other things that these former Soviet satellite states of theirs say and don't want that in their countries anymore. They keep calling it sacrilegious as though to be against what the Soviet Union did for them. They always have to say that they were liberated, they were saved, they were this and that. And as long as these countries go along with that idea because they don't want to say anything nice about the Third Reich and they want that to be the bad guy, they're caught in this trap of this historical trap where nobody, you know, everybody is looks like a damn hypocrite, which is what they are. Yeah, we really have to break free from this. We really have to come through all this false history that we're stuck with, because if we don't, we've just constantly got these problems, and we can't even speak straightforwardly to one another. We can't even speak honestly to one another. Everybody's caught up in their narrative that they have to protect. And this leader of the Night Wolves says they will make the run to Berlin anyway, as they already indicated. Yeah, that's their intention. There's a lot of other interesting things, but this is it for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And I want to tell you that next Monday on the Heretics Hour, I'm going to be interviewing Nick Collistrom, who has written the wonderful new book, Breaking the Spell, Myth and Reality. Naturally, it's about the Holocaust. And it's a great book. I've been wanting to interview him all along, but we somehow kept missing each other because the email addresses were wrong. Both I had a wrong one for him, he had a wrong one for me, and nothing was working. So I was very busy all that time too with other things. I thought, oh well, just as well, I guess. So, but now we've got it together, and he will be on next week's Heretics Hour program. That'll be on May 5th. It's going to be very good. And then on May 11th, I'm going to have another new book writer, Warren B. Routledge, who has just come out with his book, Holocaust High Priest, Elie Wiesel, Night, The Memory Cult, and The Rise of Revisionism. And that's going to be a good one, too. I'm looking forward to both these programs. And this is where I'm going to spend my time for a while. I have been, you know, it's between Holocaust revisionism and Third Reich, World War II revisionism. And that's what I care about the most and what I want to spend my time on. I'm also doing some reading of some World War II books that I wouldn't mind talking about also. But I'm just happy to have some time to read them. So I'm going to say goodnight to you now. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this has been the Heretics Hour on April 27th, 2015. See you next week, I hope.